Linguistic generalization and individual body experience. If we look at what creates the representational character of signs, it's not very difficult to conclude that it literally lives on generalizations. In this sense, scientific concepts belong to the few languages capable of surviving without the physical perceptions of the individuals who speak its discourse. According to the same evolutionary scheme, which creates the status of signs as non-religious and non-metaphysical operation, no one would dare to say anymore that it was non-ideological, science itself derives much of its status from its capacity to be abstract, between brackets, that is. Originally, the construction of what abstraction is has been derived from the mathematical model of natural sciences, that is, one gives a number to a thing and then it has a unit to juggle with. This type of abstraction is doubtless Cartesian. To give a formula for a constitution of matter, one can create a discourse that leaves out lengthy descriptions about that which is unimportant. It is a way to create a discourse on the method, as Descartes described so lengthy. In doing so, what seems to be an abstract discourse is born. Partly, it becomes abstract because of its inaccessibility to those unable to know its rules. Partly, it becomes inaccessible to those whose language does not seem to have the capacity for abstraction, which is an old but grand and quite persistent prejudice about the so-called primitive languages. And last but not least, partly because it seems to pluralize phenomena to a level at which they can be tested as hypothetical theories. There is something odd and remarkable about these operations and processes. In creating abstract formulas, there seems to be no difference between abstraction and generalization. In fact, all generalizations are called abstract, and a closer look usually shows that what is called abstraction is hardly more than a pluralized, average generalization. Franz Boas once explained that abstraction might not be part of a language, but that it is within the capacity of every language to create abstraction as soon as the need arises. Nevertheless, the scientific process hardly ever pluralizes beyond the level of general categories. The need for abstraction is pretty much defined through the convenience of the situation, which seems rather inclined to ensure the continuity of the middle brow. If social science wants hypotheses for testing or texts as a reference, it could much better do without abstraction and be much more comfortable on the level of generalization. Social science, then, I found, usually is pretty poor where abstractions are concerned. It seems that abstractions are similar to events that serve a scientific purpose, or, as Steven Tyler once explained, do not fit in within the everlasting Cartesian matrix, to which I might add, they do not fit in within the everlasting. What might be good for science, or more particular some scientists, has been questioned with increasing worry by a great many others, scientists too. Roland Barthes, for instance, writes, "My body cannot accommodate itself to generality, to the power of generality, which is in language." Isn't that an individualistic view? As a social scientist, I too have learned that language is not merely a means of expression and communication, but also a means of control. As a means of abstraction, it enables us to generate concepts rather than things. Simultaneously, however, the power of language to disembody is one of the most horrifying of human capacities. In social scientific theory, there is a tendency to reify such concepts as the self and the other without regard for the living human beings who communicate through, with, for, and about their bodies. The last 10 years have seen an incredible amount of writing linking the human body to various social contexts. Awareness of this topic has irreversibly claimed its place in the social sciences. From the earlier work on body behavior and body language, such as Birdwhistle, Hall, Poietus, Polemus, and their likes, the accent has come to fall on images of the body. Excellent extended study, of course, such as The Human Body, Fragments, Feher, The Body and Society of Turner, suggest the robustness of the topic. On the other hand, the topic has become somewhat fashionable. The incorporation of the body into social theory has often failed to change the latter, but had instead reinforced existing theoretical paradigms, incarnating those same theory in their own bodies, so to speak. This in itself is at least remarkable. What was intended to provide a fresh outlook on our existing theories, in fact, runs the risk of inscribing theoretical texts on the body. No truly revolutionary changes have occurred, even though new and exciting research material has been presented by a great many authors. What has happened? Have our theories become stereotypes of themselves? Reifications in their own reflexivity? Apparently, social scientific discourse, especially textuality, has taken over our linguistic capacity to speak about the body without the mediation of metaphors or symbols. This is largely because of the body gaze, which offers that same possibility as postmodernism does nowadays. Our body have become extensions of our theories while remaining mute simulacra of themselves. From the postmodern world and within mass culture, numerous body images are being created. These body images do not seem to be of flesh and blood, as would be the case with simplified racial features. They reflect in part a dualistic worldview expressed by such linguistically mediated oppositions as nature-culture, female-male, individual and society, and so on. They are now infinitely more refined, more difficult to analyze, and more dangerous than ever. These body images are primarily produced by those groups in society that profit from mass consumerism: fashion designers, advertisers, politicians, medics, and many more groups are all having a stake in constructing body images as close to their liking as possible. Roland Barthes stated, "To write the body, neither the skin, nor the muscles, nor the bones, nor the nerves, but the rest, an equid, fibrous, shaggy, reveling thing, a clown's coat." His ideas beg the question, what is the body anyway? If we look at its epistemological history, we soon have to conclude that it consists of textuality, and of textuality alone, as it must. In the many fine works written about the body, one aspect has never reached the arena of intellectual discussion, namely, that our bodies make us the individuals we are. Each of us lives in a specific body, whose existence eludes such linguistic attributes as cultural, natural, feminine, masculine, political, or discursive. What remains is the nagging sense of absence regarding the bodies of individuals, because the dominating powers of representation have not been eluded. Nevertheless, many discussions persist about the subjectification of the individual body. If we look at Foucault's Discipline and Punishment, the individual body has become a mere shadow in a panoptic space, subjected to discourse. If we look at Freud's totem and taboo, the individual body itself has been subjected to the unconscious, the ego, the it, sexuality, censorship, in short, at least 5 bodies at the same time. However, Barbara Stafford's Body Criticism, a work from 1990, displays an individual body which has been subjected to a history of dissection and abstraction. The work of Dorinda Outram in The Body and the French Revolution explains that all body is a political image that arose from the French Revolution, not for the purpose of individuality, but for the purpose of creating a middle class, a body politic, so to speak. And last but not least, Frederick Jameson, in his Postmodernism, or The Cultural Logic of Late Capitalism, argues that the individual body has been lost in a postmodern space of late capitalism. Whatever the body seems to express, theories indeed suggest that there is a possible consensus about the meaning of that same expression. This prospective consensus links the human body everlastingly to the generality of the natural, social, and linguistic sciences. Ferdinand de Saussure made it quite clear in his course of general linguistics that the characteristics that animals of the same species have in common are much more significant than the differences that separates them. Did scientists really ever disagree with him on this? A consensus on the body, however, would rule out the body as spatial individual expression and would turn it into a historical sequence. This timely distance results in a sort of ping-pong game between nature and culture, in which the individual body is either a scale denomination, in other words, one example of the species, an enlargement of itself, like society is a body, or a discursive construction, the cultured personality. If we leave aside for a moment the body as a gift from God or a product of consensus, we might be able to deal with the more pressing matters, such as appropriate attitudes towards our own scientific theories. To this end, one of the most intriguing linguists and anthropologists I have come across is Edward Sapir, whom I experience as a summer breeze in the winter of moralistic criticism. Sapir was a free man, unspoiled by the fragmentation and determined to describe the ontology of language rather than its epistemology. Dramatically, one might say he himself became the victim of ruling body images, being Jewish by birth and working in a climate of academic anti-Semitism. One story has it that he died of grief as an indirect consequence of academic isolation. Sapir suggests that language is largely a process of classification, where delimitation is crucial. For example, to understand a stream of speech, a native speaker refers to phonetic stations, that is, to isolated sounds that create psychological barriers which enable us to recognize the gaps between sounds and thus recognize and distinguish symbols referring to one thing or another. Language thus imposes form on phenomena. Essential to any given language is its system of differentiation on the one hand and its system of barriers or limitations on the other hand. This systematic practice of differentiation and limitation constitute what I like to call the art of recognition. In Sapir's words, it is highly important to realize that once the form of language is established, it can discover meanings for its speakers which do not simply are traceable to the given quality of the experience itself, but must be explained to a large extent as the projection of potential meanings into the raw material of experience. It is exactly this raw material of experience, and yet unclassified by language, which seems the closest to the individual body. Once it is classified through language, the experience of the individual body gets linked to a field of symbolic reverence. Like the body each of us is born with, each field of reverence, that is, each language, differs from every other and is not for our choosing. Each language, like each body, is an accidental inheritance. However, unlike our own bodies, language is a communal enterprise, the historical collective process, which is symbolic construction of the body image, which is it is called, seduces each individual body into identification with its chain and causes and effects. Therefore, says Sapir, language simultaneously helps and hinders us, renders us retarded in the exploration of our own individual experiences. For Sapir, the individual aspects of language remain ever close to the body. This includes such factors as tone of voice and personal voice characteristics, what I might call the domain of adverbs. It will be obvious why individual body expression gets so easily lost in the social sciences insofar as we rely upon a culture of writing and reading. There are, however, elements in a social sciences that go beyond the mere fact of our dependence on writing. First of all, we should realize that social sciences are entirely dominated by the Western concepts of the body. Despite of the escapist tricks that the rhetorics of the social sciences may employ, their practices still betray their Platonist Cartesian origin, whose essence is the assumed split of body and mind, which places the abstract and the superior mind in the natural and inferior body. This assumed schism is reflected in a dualizing linguistic practice that long pre-existed the social sciences and which, in Sapir's view, projects potential meanings onto the raw material of experience. Abstract discourse, Cartesian style, still dominate the social sciences, even as it seeks to dominate the so-called primitive peoples, whose ranks nowadays include those who do not wish to comply with virtual reality, who are not supposed to have any capacity for abstract language. Such nonconformists are liable to be seen as little more than animals following the rules of their collective body, not unlike Descartes' animal bodies. One can in fact wonder whether the body-mind split is indeed about the mind. I, for one, feel that it is more appropriately understood as the split between the body and the discursive perceptions of the body. In other words, between the body and language, as well as the discourse of power over the body and the body of others. It is no longer politically correct to label technologically less advanced non-Western cultures as primitive. Such a practice is today labeled as inexcusable ethnocentric, which it generally is. However, other ethnocentric notions from Western science have been spared such attacks. The issue of ethnocentrism seemed to have blocked out questions pertaining to the habitual use of abstract notions, or, more accurately, to the application of generalizations and grammatical structures to the body. In many studies, the objectivity of both these concepts is being questioned. But basically, the method itself has remained intact. In Steven Tyler's words, the king has been dethroned, but the kingdom still exists. At the same time, the concept of objectivity in social science is under pressure. The shift in cultural relativism has been moving towards an awareness that the existence of individual body is itself a Western construction, anchored in the history of the French Revolution. This construction might be referred to as a Rousseauian image of humans. And it might therefore not be applicable to the non-Western cultures. One must question, however, whether this so-called Western construction of the individual body really is an individual as it is advertised. Is it indeed individual? Or is it an image of a public perception, whereby some individuals and male bodies are more individuals than other female bodies? Or, in George Orwell's politically canny phrase, are some bodies more equal than others? It is perhaps more to the point to be aware that the mere fact of such images does not negate the fact of the personal expression of the individual body. But the sum total of our means of interpretation might not reveal this, so long as the expressive force of language remains hidden behind the alleged oppositions of social scientific discourse. Prophetically enough, Sapir warned us about this tendency. Language is heuristic in the far more reaching sense that it predetermines for us certain modes of observation and interpretation. This means, of course, that our scientific experiences grow. We must learn to fight the implications of language. Now, one could easily say that Sapir was blind to the economy of language and naive about the growth of scientific experience, just as one could say that Bourdieu is equally cynical about both. But the process Sapir fears here engages more than the heuristic of language alone. It also warns of a language process in which individual bodies are fragmented by observation, and subsequently incorporated into a larger body, that of the modern industrial society. For Sapir, were he alive today, the heuristic society itself would have condemned the individual body to the experience of a spurious culture. In his article, Culture, Gentlemen and Spurious, he is quite clear about this. An automatic perception of standardized value, not subject to constant remodeling of individualists, willing to put a part of themselves into the forms they receive from their predecessors, leads to the dominance of impersonal formulas. The individual is left out in the cold. Culture becomes a manner rather than a way of life. It ceases to be genuine. In the light of this observation, we are left with a body that needs to fight the implication of language in order to survive its external alienation. The outcome of such a process is comparable with Jameson's views on the outcome of postmodernism. It all depends on one's orientation. Postmodernism is in fact no more than an attempt to offer some deconstructions of these body positions, as well as deconstructions of an overarching cultural determinant in which society itself has become an industrial body, and in which individuals seem to exist primarily as components of a grammatical language. It should become clear that this body has little to do with the organics of society in the traditional sense of the word. It more resembles a product, for example, an artificial grammatical construction, than it does a given social community. For its recent development has been in terms of global economy, rather than of those of a traditional society. And this entails a great risk, as Jameson points out. What happens is that a more powerful vision of some increasingly total system of logic, the more powerless the reader comes to feel insofar as the theory wins. Therefore, by constructing an increasingly closed and terrific machine, to that very large degree he loses, since the critical capacity of his work is thereby paralyzed, and the impulses of negation and revolt, not to speak of those of social transformation, are increasingly perceived as vain and trivial in the face of the model itself.